Chapter 2. The Revision and Reenchantment of Psychology, Legacy from a Half-Century of Consciousness Research, Part 3.
When they are working through the problems of rivalry with their siblings, patients may attempt to monopolize the therapist and want to be the only, or at least the favorite, patient. They find it difficult to accept that the therapist has other patients and can be extremely irritated by any sign of interest paid to somebody else. Patients who on other occasions do not mind or even wish to be left alone during a session cannot bear for the therapist to leave the room for any reason when they are connecting with memories related to abandonment and childhood loneliness. These are just a few examples of situations in which oversensitivity to external circumstances reflects an underlying COEX system. The common denominator in the COEX systems we have described so far is the quality of emotions or physical feelings that their layers share. There also exists a different category of COEX systems that can be referred to as interpersonal COEX systems. In these dynamic constellations, the common denominator is a certain type of relationship to a specific category of people, authority figures, sexual partners, or peers. Knowledge of these systems is extremely important for understanding the dynamics of the therapeutic process and the interpersonal problems that might develop between therapists or sitters and individuals who are in holotropic states of consciousness. It is also one of the most important therapeutic mechanisms in psychotherapy. In the world of psychotherapy, there are many schools which show a disturbing lack of agreement about some fundamental issues. What are the dimensions of the human psyche? What are its most important motivating forces? Why do emotional and psychosomatic symptoms develop? What do they mean? And why do they take a specific form? And what techniques and strategies should be used in the work with clients? As a result, the psychotherapeutic procedures and the interpretations of the same psychological content are very different from school to school. Studies of therapeutic results have shown some difference between being in psychotherapy and being on the waiting list, but failed to demonstrate any significant differences between the results of different schools. The differences are instead found inside the schools rather than between them. In each of the schools, there are individuals who are known as better therapists than their colleagues. This brings up some interesting questions. What are the effective mechanisms in psychotherapy? When can verbal therapy help and why? And what are its limits? It is clear that the answer is not to have a better understanding of the psyche and more accurate and better timed interpretations, because these are factors that vary from one school to another. Some factors that have been mentioned as effective, on the other hand, are the quality of the human encounter between the therapist and client, compatibility and resonance between the personalities of the therapist and patient, and the feeling of being unconditionally accepted by another human being, often for the first time in one's life. Astrologers would talk about harmonious alignment between the charts of the two individuals. It seems that breaking repetitive traumatic patterns in interpersonal relations or interpersonal COEX systems might play a critical role in successful therapy. An interesting study we conducted at the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague about 50 years ago demonstrated this. This study focused on the following problem. When we look at the lives of people who have emotional or psychosomatic disorders, we discover that they tend to repeat the same kind of dysfunctional patterns in relationships with certain categories of relationships: figures in positions of authority, men, women, sexual partners, or peers. Their partners in these relationships might have very different personalities, but these clients tend to eventually develop the same kind of problems. The research that we conducted at the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague was called Study of the Development of Interpersonal Relationships. We selected 18 patients from our outpatient department, 9 men and 9 women. None of these patients knew any of the others before beginning the study. We emptied our open-door inpatient department and admitted all these patients on the same day. In the afternoon on the first day, they sat down in 3 randomly selected circles of 6 and were given questionnaires based on Timothy Leary's Interpersonal Diagnostic Test of Personality. This was a personality test that made Leary famous long before he took any psychedelic substances. Leary's questions about interpersonal relationships can be arranged on a system of coordinates where the vertical axis, ordinate, is dominance/submission, and the horizontal axis, abscissa, is hate/love. They describe various combinations of these 4 attributes. For our project, the questions in the questionnaires describing the nature of the relationships of the patients to their co-patients were formulated in the future tense. They were thus guessing what kind of relationships they would have with their co-patients before they knew anything about them. Following their admission, these patients then lived together in our institute for 4 weeks. They had a rich program consisting of various sports, artistic activity, occupational therapy, walks in nature, games, cultural events, etc. At the end of each week, they were again given the same interpersonal questionnaires, this time formulated in the present tense, describing the actual relationships they were having with their co-patients. After the patients chose the statements describing the nature of their relationships, e.g., he or she is criticizing me, trying to control me, is supporting me, is affectionate with me, etc., the results were entered into a graph with the 2 coordinates and concentric circles resembling a target for archery. According to Leary, the resulting pattern of a person with healthy relationships would be relatively balanced. Dysfunctional relationships would result in patterns heavily loaded in some of the quadrants. This research brought some interesting results. It showed that in patients whose initial graphs showed strong expectations of dysfunctional relationships with specific co-patients, future descriptions of the actual relationships showed strong convergence with the initial expectations, self-fulfilling prophecy. The next step in the study was then asking the patients to use the same questionnaire in the past tense and describe their relationships with the members of their family of origin. Dysfunctional repetitive patterns could be traced to the dynamics of the nuclear family. Issues with authority figures, teachers, bosses, military officers, etc., were connected to parents who imposed discipline in the family. Problems in sexual relationships to one of the parents, or the pattern of their marriage, and conflicts with the peer group to sibling rivalry. The critical period was the age of 5 or 6, when the children start to apply patterns of interpersonal behavior established within a very unrepresentative sample of the population, nuclear family, to a larger community, teachers, schoolmates, and various acquaintances. The question then was, are these patterns going to be corrected or reinforced? Since human relationships are complementary, an average person tends to respond in a predictable and expected way, and thus reinforces a dysfunctional pattern. The task of a good teacher, ideal boss, and eventually the therapist is to respond in an atypical and unexpected way, to break the repetitive pattern and provide a corrective experience. The task of the therapist is particularly challenging and critical. By the time the client comes to a therapist, the dysfunctional patterns have been reinforced through many repetitions. Psychotherapy cannot be neutral. It either reinforces the client's dysfunctional patterns or provides a corrective experience. In psychotherapy, this is known as the Jean Valjean phenomenon. Here is the story from Victor Hugo's Les Misérables that gave it the name. The convict, Jean Valjean, is released from a French prison after serving 19 years for stealing a loaf of bread and for subsequent attempts to escape from prison. When Valjean arrives in a town, no one is willing to give him shelter because he is an ex-convict. Desperate, Valjean knocks on the door of a kind bishop who treats Valjean with great kindness as a valued guest. Valjean repays the bishop by stealing his silverware and taking off. When the policemen arrest Valjean, they recognize the initials on the silverware and take him back to the bishop's house. The bishop covers for him, claiming that the silverware was a gift. The gendarmes release Valjean, and the bishop makes him promise to become an honest man. Under an assumed name, Valjean invents an ingenious manufacturing process that brings the town prosperity. He becomes an honest man and is eventually voted the town's mayor. When we are working with holotropic states, it is important to be aware of the client's repetitive interpersonal patterns, because these can become activated and amplified and create difficult situations in therapy. However, regression in holotropic states also provides an extraordinary opportunity for a corrective experience on a very deep level. The presence of a strong and loving male or female, the simultaneous presence of a male and female who get along unlike one's parents, and the satisfaction of unmet anaclitic needs experienced in deep regression can have an extraordinary healing and transformative effect on the previously afflicted categories of interpersonal relationships. The perinatal level of the unconscious. When our process of deep experiential self-exploration moves beyond the level of memories from childhood and infancy and reaches back to birth, we start encountering emotions and physical sensations of extreme intensity, often surpassing anything we previously considered possible. At this point, the experiences become a strange mixture of being born and dying. They involve a sense of severe, life-threatening confinement and a desperate and determined struggle to free ourselves and survive. Due to the close connection between this domain of the unconscious and biological birth, I have chosen for it the name perinatal. It is a Greek-Latin composite word in which the prefix peri means near or around, and the root natalis signifies pertaining to birth. This word is commonly used in medicine to describe various biological processes occurring shortly before, during, and immediately after birth. The obstetricians talk, for example, about perinatal hemorrhage, infection, or brain damage. However, since according to traditional medicine, the child does not consciously experience birth, and this event is not recorded in memory, one never hears about perinatal experiences. The use of the term perinatal in connection with consciousness reflects my own findings and is entirely new. The strong representation of birth and death in our unconscious psyche and the close association between them might surprise mainstream psychologists and psychiatrists, since it challenges their deeply ingrained beliefs. According to the traditional medical view, only a birth so difficult that it causes irreversible damage to the brain cells can have psychopathological consequences, and even then mostly of a neurological nature such as mental retardation or hyperactivity. The official position of academic psychiatry is that biological birth is not recorded in memory and does not constitute a psychotrauma. The usual reason for denying the possibility of birth memory is that the cerebral cortex of the newborn is not mature enough to mediate the experiencing and recording of this event. More specifically, the cortical neurons are not yet fully myelinized, which means completely covered with the protective sheaths of a fatty substance called myelin. Surprisingly, this same argument is not used to deny the existence and importance of memories from the time of nursing, a period that immediately follows birth. The psychological significance of the experiences of nursing and even bonding, the exchange of looks and physical contact between the mother and child immediately after birth, is generally recognized and acknowledged by mainstream obstetricians, pediatricians, and child psychiatrists. The image of the newborn as an unconscious and unresponsive organism is also in sharp conflict with the growing body of literature describing the remarkable sensitivity of the fetus during the prenatal period. The denial of the possibility of birth memory based on the fact that the cerebral cortex of the newborn is not fully myelinized is particularly absurd, considering that the capacity for memory exists in much lower life forms that do not have a cerebral cortex at all. In 2001, an American neuroscientist of Austrian origin, Erich Kandel, received a Nobel Prize in Physiology for his research of the memory mechanism of the sea slug Aplysia, an organism incomparably more primitive than the newborn human child. And it is well known that certain primitive forms of protoplasmic memory exist even in unicellular organisms. The most likely explanation of this striking logical inconsistency occurring in individuals trained in rigorous scientific thinking is the psychological repression of the terrifying memory of biological birth. The amount of emotional and physical stress involved in childbirth clearly surpasses that of any postnatal trauma in infancy and childhood discussed in psychodynamic literature, with the possible exception of extreme forms of physical abuse. Various forms of experiential psychotherapy have amassed convincing evidence that biological birth is the most profound trauma of our life and an event of paramount psychospiritual importance. It is recorded in our memory in minuscule details down to the cellular level, and it has a profound effect on our psychological development. Reliving various aspects of biological birth can be very convincing, and the process often replays in photographic detail. This can occur even in people who have no intellectual knowledge about their birth and lack elementary obstetric information. All of these details can be confirmed if good birth records or reliable personal witnesses are available. For example, we can discover through direct experience that we had a breech birth, that forceps were used during our delivery, or that we were born with the umbilical cord twisted around the neck. We can feel the anxiety, biological fury, physical pain, and suffocation that we experienced during birth, and even accurately recognize the type of anesthesia used when we were born. This is often accompanied by various postures and movements of the body, arms, and legs, as well as rotations, flexions, and deflections of the head that accurately recreate the mechanics of a particular type of delivery. When we are reliving birth, bruises, swellings, and other vascular changes can unexpectedly appear on the skin, in the places where the forceps were applied, or where the umbilical cord was constricting the throat. These observations suggest that the record of the trauma of birth reaches all the way down to the cellular level. The intimate connection between birth and death in our unconscious psyche makes eminent sense. It reflects the fact that birth is a potentially or actually life-threatening event. The delivery brutally terminates the intrauterine existence of the fetus. The fetus dies as an aquatic organism and is born as an air-breathing, physiologically, and even anatomically different form of life. Its collapsed lungs expand, and together with the kidneys and the gastrointestinal system, take over the functions previously performed by the placenta: breathing, excretion of urine, and elimination of the waste products. The passage through the birth canal is, in and of itself, a difficult and potentially dangerous process that can bring us close to death. Various complications of birth, such as a serious discrepancy between the size of the child and the pelvic opening, the transversal position of the fetus, breech birth, or placenta previa, can further increase the emotional and physical challenges associated with this process. The child and the mother can lose their lives during delivery, and children might be born severely blue from asphyxiation, or even dead and in need of resuscitation. The conscious reliving and integration of the trauma of birth plays an important role in the process of experiential psychotherapy and self-exploration. The experiences originating on the perinatal level of the unconscious appear in four distinct experiential patterns, each of which is characterized by specific emotions, physical feelings, and symbolic imagery. These patterns are closely related to the experiences that the fetus has before the onset of birth and during the three consecutive stages of biological delivery. These experiences leave deep, unconscious imprints in the psyche that later in life have an important influence on the individual. I refer to these four dynamic constellations in the deep unconscious as basic perinatal matrices, or BPMs. The spectrum of perinatal experiences is not limited to those that can be derived from the biological and psychological processes involved in childbirth. Perinatal matrices form integral parts of coex systems that also contain postnatal memories and transpersonal experiences with which they share the same archetypal qualities. These can alternate with the reliving of the fetal memories or appear simultaneously with them in various combinations. The BPMs represent important gateways to the collective unconscious described by C.G. Jung: identification with the infant facing the ordeal of the passage through the birth canal seems to provide access to experiences involving people from other times and cultures, various animals, and even mythological figures. It is as if by connecting with the fetus struggling to be born, one connects in an intimate, almost mystical way with other sentient beings who are in a similar predicament. The connections between the experiences of the consecutive stages of biological birth and various symbolic images associated with them are very specific and consistent. The reason why they emerge together is not understandable in terms of conventional logic. However, that does not mean that these associations are arbitrary and random. They have their own deep order that can best be referred to as experiential logic. What this means is that the connection between the experiences characteristic for various stages of birth and the concomitant symbolic themes are not based on some formal external similarity, but on the fact that they share the same emotional feelings and physical sensations. Perinatal matrices are rich and complex and have specific biological and psychological features, as well as archetypal connections. Experiential confrontation with birth and death seems to result automatically in a spiritual opening and the discovery of the mystical dimensions of the psyche and of existence. Once the age regression reaches the perinatal level, a new experiential quality enters the experience. C.G. Jung used the name numinosity, a term that he borrowed from Rudolf Otto. This neutral term makes it possible to avoid words with a similar meaning that have been used in various contexts and could be easily misunderstood, such as religious, sacred, spiritual, mystical, or magical. The encounter with perinatal matrices can occur in sessions with psychedelic substances during holotropic breathwork in the course of spontaneous psycho-spiritual crises, spiritual emergencies, or in actual life situations, such as during childbirth or in near-death experiences, NDEs. The specific symbolism of these experiences comes from the collective unconscious, not from the individual memory banks. It can thus draw on any historical period, geographical area, and spiritual tradition of the world, quite independently from the subject's cultural or religious background. Individual perinatal matrices have connections with certain categories of postnatal experiences that share the same archetypal qualities and belong to the same coax systems. They also have associations with the archetypes of Mother Nature, the Great Mother Goddess, Heaven and Paradise, BPM 1, the Terrible Mother Goddess and Hell, BPM 2, Sabbath of the Witches and Satanic Rituals, BPM 3, Purgatory and deities from different cultures representing death and rebirth, BPM 3 and 4, and Divine Epiphany, the alchemical Cauda Pavonis, Peacock Tail, and Rainbow Arc, BPM 4. Later in the book, we will explore the remarkable parallels between the phenomenology of BPMs 1 through 4 and the astrological archetypes Neptune, Saturn, Pluto, and Uranus. Additional types of experiences that can be included in the same coax system as perinatal matrices are ancestral, racial, collective, karmic, and phylogenetic memories. We should also mention theoretically and practically important links between BPMs and specific aspects of physiological activities in the Freudian erogenous zones and to specific categories of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. Reinforced by strong, emotionally charged experiences from infancy, childhood, and later life, perinatal matrices can shape our perception of the world, profoundly influence our everyday behavior, and contribute to the development of various emotional and psychosomatic disorders. On a collective scale, perinatal matrices play an important role in religion, art, mythology, philosophy, and various socio-political phenomena, such as totalitarian systems, wars, revolutions, and genocide. We will explore these broader implications of perinatal dynamics in later chapters. First Basic Perinatal Matrix, BPM 1, Primal Union with the Mother. This matrix is related to the intrauterine existence before the onset of the delivery. The experiential world of this period can be referred to as the amniotic universe. When we identify with the fetus in the womb, we do not have the awareness of boundaries and do not differentiate between the inner and the outer. This is reflected in the nature of the experiences associated with reliving the memory of the prenatal state. During episodes of undisturbed embryonic existence, we typically have experiences of vast regions with no boundaries or limits, interstellar space, galaxies, or the entire cosmos. A related experience is floating in the sea, identifying with various aquatic animals such as fish, jellyfish, dolphins, or whales, or even becoming the ocean. This seems to reflect the fact that the fetus is essentially an aquatic creature. Positive intrauterine experiences can also be associated with archetypal visions of Mother Nature, safe, beautiful, and unconditionally nourishing, like a good womb. We can envision fruit-bearing orchards, fields of ripe corn, agricultural terraces in the Andes, or unspoiled Polynesian islands. Mythological images from the collective unconscious that often appear in this context portray various celestial realms and paradises as they are described in mythologies of different cultures, even those of which we have no intellectual knowledge. The type of ecstasy associated with BPM-1 can be called Apollonian or oceanic. It is characterized by the transcendence of time and space, feelings of peace, tranquility, clarity, and cosmic unity. When we are reliving episodes of intrauterine disturbances, memories of the bad womb, we have a sense of a dark and ominous threat, and often feel that we are being poisoned. We might see images that portray polluted waters and toxic dumps. This reflects the fact that many prenatal disturbances are caused by toxic changes in the body of the pregnant mother. Sequences of this kind can be associated with archetypal visions of frightening, demonic entities, or with a sense of insidious, all-pervading evil. Those of us who are reliving episodes of a more violent interference with prenatal existence, such as an imminent miscarriage or attempted abortion, usually experience some form of universal threat or bloody apocalyptic visions of the end of the world. This again reflects the intimate interconnections between events in our biological history and the Jungian archetypes. The following account of a high-dose psychedelic session can be used as a typical example of a BPM-1 experience, opening at times into the transpersonal realm. All that I was experiencing was an intense sense of malaise resembling a flu. I could not believe that a high dose of LSD, which in my previous sessions had produced dramatic psychological changes, could evoke such a minimal response. I decided to close my eyes and observe carefully what was happening. At this point, the experience seemed to deepen, and I realized that what with my eyes open appeared to be an adult experience of a viral disease, now changed into a realistic situation of a fetus suffering some strange toxic assaults during its intrauterine existence. I was greatly reduced in size, and my head was considerably bigger than the rest of my body and my extremities. I was suspended in a liquid milieu, and some harmful chemicals were being channeled into my body through the umbilical area. Using some unknown receptors, I was detecting these influences as noxious and hostile to my organism. While this was happening, I was aware that these toxic attacks had something to do with the condition and activity of the body of my mother. Occasionally, I could distinguish influences that appeared to be due to the ingestion of alcohol, inappropriate food, or smoking. A different kind of discomfort seemed to be caused by chemical changes accompanying my mother's emotions. Anxieties, nervousness, anger, and conflicting feelings about pregnancy. Then the feelings of sickness and indigestion disappeared, and I was experiencing an ever-increasing state of ecstasy. This was accompanied by a clearing and brightening of my visual field. It was as if multiple layers of thick, dirty cobwebs were being magically torn and dissolved, or a movie projection or television broadcast was brought into focus by an invisible cosmic technician. The scenery opened up, and an incredible amount of light and energy enveloped me and streamed in subtle vibrations through my whole being. On one level, I was still a fetus experiencing the ultimate perfection and bliss of a good womb, or a newborn fusing with a nourishing and life-giving breast. On another level, I became the entire universe. I was witnessing the spectacle of the macrocosm with countless pulsating and vibrating galaxies. And at the same time, I was it. These radiant and breathtaking cosmic vistas were intertwined with experiences of the equally miraculous microcosm. From the dance of atoms and molecules to the origins of life and the biochemical world of individual cells. For the first time, I was experiencing the universe for what it really is. An unfathomable mystery, a divine play of absolute consciousness. For some time, I was oscillating between the state of a distressed, sickened fetus and a blissful and serene intrauterine existence. At times, the noxious influences took the form of insidious demons or malevolent creatures from the world of spiritual scriptures or fairy tales. During the undisturbed episodes of fetal existence, I experienced feelings of basic identity and oneness with the universe. It was the Tao, the beyond that is within. The Tat Dvam Asi, thou art that, of the Upanishads. I lost my sense of individuality. My ego dissolved, and I became all of existence. Sometimes this experience was intangible and contentless. Sometimes it was accompanied by many beautiful visions. Archetypal images of paradise, the ultimate cornucopia, golden age, or virginal nature. I became a dolphin playing in the ocean, a fish swimming in crystal clear waters, a butterfly floating over mountain meadows, and a seagull gliding over the sea. I was the ocean, animals, plants, the clouds, sometimes all these at the same time. Nothing concrete happened later in the afternoon and in the evening hours. I spent most of this time feeling at one with nature and the universe, bathed in golden light that was slowly decreasing in intensity. Second perinatal matrix, BPM2, cosmic engulfment, no exit, or hell. While reliving the onset of biological birth, we typically feel that we are being sucked into a gigantic whirlpool or swallowed by some mythic beast. We might also experience the entire world or cosmos being engulfed. This can be associated with images of devouring or entangling archetypal monsters, such as leviathans, dragons, whales, giant snakes, tarantulas, or octopuses. The sense of overwhelming vital threat can lead to intense anxiety and general mistrust bordering on paranoia. Another experiential variety of the beginning of the second matrix is the theme of descending into the depths of the underworld, the realm of death, or hell. As Joseph Campbell so eloquently described, this is a universal motif in the mythologies of the hero's journey. In the fully developed first stage of biological birth, the basis of BPM2, the uterine contractions periodically constrict the fetus, and the cervix is not yet open. Each contraction causes compression of the uterine arteries, and the fetus is threatened by lack of oxygen. Reliving this stage of birth is one of the worst experiences we can have during self-exploration that involves holotropic states. We feel caught in a monstrous claustrophobic nightmare, exposed to agonizing emotional and physical pain, and have a sense of utter helplessness and hopelessness. Feelings of loneliness, guilt, the absurdity of life, and existential despair reach metaphysical proportions. A person in this predicament typically loses their sense of linear time and becomes convinced that the situation will never end and that there is absolutely no way out. An experiential triad characteristic for this state is fear of dying, going crazy, and never coming back. Reliving this stage of birth is usually accompanied by transpersonal experiences that involve people, animals, and even mythological beings in a painful and hopeless predicament, similar to that of the fetus caught in the relentless grip of the contracting uterus. We can experience identification with prisoners in dungeons, victims of the Inquisition, and inmates in concentration camps or insane asylums. Our suffering can take the form of the pain of animals caught in traps or even reach dimensions that are archetypal. We can experience the torture of sinners in hell, the agony of Jesus on the cross, or the excruciating torments of Greek archetypal figures representing endless suffering. Sisyphus rolling his boulder up the mountain in the deepest pit of Hades. Prometheus chained to a rock in the Caucasus Mountains and having his liver eaten by an eagle. Tantalus vexed by hunger and thirst, with luscious fruit and fresh water just out of his reach. And Ixion, attached to a fiery wheel, spinning through the air in the underworld. While we are under the influence of this matrix, we are selectively blinded and unable to see anything positive in our life and in human existence in general. The connection to the divine dimension seems to be irretrievably severed and lost. Through the prism of this matrix, life seems to be a meaningless theater of the absurd, a farce staging of cardboard characters and mindless robots, or a cruel circus sideshow. In this state of mind, existential philosophy appears to be the only true and unabashed description of existence. It is interesting in this regard that Jean-Paul Sartre's work was deeply influenced by a badly managed and unresolved mescaline session dominated by BPM2. Samuel Beckett's preoccupation with death and birth and his search for mother also reveal strong perinatal influence. It is only natural that someone confronted with this abysmal aspect of the psyche would feel a great reluctance to face it. Going deeper into this experience seems like meeting eternal damnation. Yet, paradoxically, the fastest way of ending this unbearable state is to fully experience the depth of suffering and despair that we once had to face in the birth canal, surrendering to it completely and accepting it. That changes the seemingly hopeless situation of BPM2 into BPM3, reliving the stage of birth where the dilated cervix makes escape and the termination of suffering possible. Saint John of the Cross gave this shattering experience of terrifying darkness and utter despair the name Dark Night of the Soul, and C.G. Jung called it the Night Sea Journey. In her autobiography, Saint Teresa described hell as a suffocating place of unendurable torments, which she experienced while she was cramped in a small hole. BPM2 is an important stage of a spiritual opening that can have an immensely purging and liberating effect. The most characteristic features of BPM2 can be illustrated by the following account from a high-dose psychedelic session. The atmosphere seemed increasingly ominous and fraught with hidden danger. It seemed that the entire room started to turn, and I felt drawn into the very center of a threatening whirlpool. I thought about Edgar Allan Poe's chilling description of a similar situation in his story, A Descent into the Maelstrom. As the objects in the room seemed to be flying around me in a rotating motion, another image from literature emerged in my mind. The cyclone in Frank Baum's wonderful Wizard of Oz that sweeps Dorothy away from the monotony of her life in Kansas and sends her on a strange journey of adventure. My experience also had something to do with entering the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland, and I awaited with great trepidation what world I would find on the other side of the looking glass. The entire universe seemed to be closing in on me, and there was nothing I could do to stop this apocalyptic engulfment. As I was sinking deeper and deeper into the labyrinth of my own unconscious, I felt an onslaught of anxiety turning to panic. Everything became dark, oppressive, and terrifying. It was as if the weight of the whole world was encroaching on me, exerting incredible hydraulic pressure that threatened to crack my skull and reduce my body to a tiny, compact ball. A rapid fugue of memories from my past cascaded through my brain, showing me the utter futility and meaninglessness of my life and existence in general. We are born naked, frightened, and in agony, and we will leave the world the same way. The existentialists were right. Everything is impermanent. Life is nothing else but waiting for Godot. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. The discomfort I felt turned to pain, and the pain increased to agony. The torture intensified to the point where every cell in my body felt like it was being bored open with a diabolic dentist drill. Visions of infernal landscapes and devils torturing their victims suddenly brought me to the awareness that I was in hell. I thought of Dante's Divine Comedy, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter." There seemed to be no way out of this diabolical situation. I was forever doomed, without the slightest hope for redemption. Third Perinatal Matrix, BPM3, The Death-Rebirth Struggle. Many aspects of this rich and colorful experience can be understood from its association with the second clinical stage of biological delivery. The propulsion through the birth canal after the cervix opens and the head descends into the pelvis. In this stage, the uterine contractions continue, but the cervix is now dilated and allows the gradual propulsion of the fetus through the birth canal. This involves crushing mechanical pressures, pains, and often a high degree of anoxia and suffocation. a natural concomitant of this highly uncomfortable and life-threatening situation is an experience of intense anxiety. Besides the interruption of blood circulation caused by uterine contractions and the ensuing compression of uterine arteries, the blood supply to the fetus can be further compromised by various complications. The umbilical cord can be squeezed between the head and the pelvic opening, or be twisted around the neck. The placenta can detach during delivery, or actually obstruct the way out. Placenta previa. In some instances, the fetus can inhale various forms of biological material that it encounters in the final stages of this process, including its own feces, meconium, which further intensifies the feelings of suffocation. The problems in this stage can be so extreme that they require instrumental intervention, such as the use of forceps, suction cup, or even an emergency cesarean section. BPM-3 is an extremely rich and complex experiential pattern. Besides the actual realistic replay of the fetus's struggle in the birth canal, it can be accompanied by a wide variety of transpersonal imagery drawn from history, nature, and archetypal realms. The most important of these are the atmosphere of titanic fight, aggressive and sadomasochistic sequences, experiences of deviant sexuality, demonic episodes, scatological involvement, and encounters with fire. Most of these aspects of BPM-3 can be meaningfully related to certain anatomical, physiological, and biochemical characteristics of the corresponding stage of birth. The titanic aspect of BPM-3 is quite understandable in view of the enormity of the forces operating in the final stage of childbirth. Powerful contractions of the uterus compressing the fetus, whose head is wedged in the narrow pelvic opening. When we encounter this facet of the third matrix, we experience streams of energy of overwhelming intensity rushing through our body and building up to explosive discharges. At this point, we might identify with raging elements of nature, such as volcanoes, electric storms, earthquakes, tidal waves, or tornadoes. The experience can also involve technology with enormous energy, tanks, rockets, spaceships, lasers, electric power plants, or even thermonuclear reactors and atomic bombs. The titanic experiences of BPM-3 can reach archetypal dimensions and portray battles of gigantic proportions, such as the cosmic battle between the forces of light and darkness, angels and devils, the Olympic gods and the Titans, or the Devas and Asuras from Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism. The aggressive and sadomasochistic aspects of this matrix reflect the biological fury of the organism, whose survival is threatened by suffocation, as well as the introjected destructive onslaught of the uterine contractions. Facing this aspect of BPM-3, we might experience cruelties of astonishing proportions, manifesting in scenes of violent murder and suicide, mutilation and automutilation, massacres of various kinds, and bloody wars and revolutions. They often take the form of torture, execution, ritual sacrifice, and self-sacrifice, bloody man-to-man combat, and sadomasochistic practices. In these experiences, violent, destructive, and self-destructive impulses are associated with strong sexual arousal. The experiential logic of the sexual aspect of the death-rebirth process is not immediately obvious. It seems that the human organism has an inbuilt physiological mechanism that translates inhuman suffering, and particularly suffocation, into a strange kind of sexual arousal, and eventually into ecstatic rapture. This can be seen in the experiences of the martyrs and flagellants described in religious literature. Additional examples can be found in material from concentration camps, from the reports of prisoners of war, and from the files of Amnesty International. It is also well known that men dying of suffocation on the gallows typically have an erection and even ejaculate. In medieval lore, mandrake, Mandragora officinarum, a psychoactive plant used in magic rituals, grew under the gallows in places sprayed by the semen of dying criminals. Sexual experiences that occur in the context of BPM-3 are characterized by the enormous intensity of the sexual drive, by their mechanical and unselective quality, and their exploitative, pornographic, or deviant nature. They depict scenes from red light districts and from the sexual underground, extravagant erotic practices, and sadomasochistic sequences. Equally frequent are episodes portraying incest and episodes of sexual abuse or rape. In rare instances, the BPM-3 imagery can involve the gory and repulsive extremes of criminal sexuality, erotically motivated murder, dismemberment, cannibalism, and necrophilia. The fact that, on this level of the psyche, sexual arousal is inextricably connected with highly problematic elements, extreme danger, threats, anxiety, aggression, inflicting pain on another organism, suffering pain from another organism, and various forms of biological material, forms a natural basis for the development of the most common types of sexual dysfunctions, variations, deviations, and perversions. Kraft Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis. The close connection between sexuality and aggression, oriented both inward and outward, found in sadomasochism, was a problem that Freud struggled with and had not satisfactorily resolved before his death. To find a plausible explanation for this condition, one has to reach beyond the Freudian model into the perinatal domain. The demonic aspect of BPM-3 can present specific problems for the subjects, as well as therapists and facilitators. The uncanny and eerie nature of the manifestations involved often leads to a reluctance to face it. The most common themes observed in this context are scenes of the Sabbath of the Witches, Valpurgis Night, satanic orgies and black mass rituals, and temptation by evil forces. The common denominator connecting the stage of childbirth with the themes of the Sabbath or with the black mass rituals is the peculiar experiential amalgam of death, deviant sexuality, pain, fear, aggression, scatology, and distorted spiritual impulses that they share. This observation seems to have great relevance for the experiences of satanic cult abuse reported by clients in various forms of regressive therapy. The scatological aspect of the death-rebirth process has its natural biological basis in the fact that, in the final stage of the delivery, the fetus can come into close contact with various forms of biological material, blood, vaginal secretions, urine, and even feces. However, the nature and content of these experiences by far exceed what the newborn might have actually experienced during birth. Experiences of this aspect of BPM-3 can involve such scenes as crawling in offal or through sewage systems, wallowing in piles of excrement, drinking blood or urine, or participating in repulsive images of putrefaction. It is an intimate and shattering encounter with the worst aspects of biological existence. When the experience of BPM-3 comes closer to resolution, it becomes less violent and disturbing. The prevailing atmosphere is that of extreme passion and driving energy of intoxicating intensity. The imagery portrays exciting conquests of new territories, hunts of wild animals, extreme sports, and adventures in amusement parks. These experiences are clearly related to activities that involve an adrenaline rush. Parachuting, bungee jumping, car racing, acrobatic diving, dangerous stunts, or circus performances, etc. At this time, we can also encounter archetypal figures or deities, demigods, and legendary heroes representing death and rebirth. We can have visions of Jesus, his torment and humiliation, the way of the cross and crucifixion, or even actually experience full identification with his suffering. Whether or not we intellectually know the corresponding mythologies, we can experience such mythological themes as the descent of the Sumerian goddess Inanna to the underworld to obtain the elixir of immortality for her deceased lover Dumuzi, the resurrection of the Egyptian god Osiris, or the death and rebirth of the Greek deities Dionysus, Attis, or Adonis. The experiences can portray Persephone's abduction by Hades, the immolation of the plumed serpent Quetzalcoatl, and his journey through the underworld, or the ordeals of the Mayan hero twins as described in the Popol Vuh. Just before the experience of psycho-spiritual rebirth, it is common to encounter the element of fire. The motif of fire can be experienced either in its ordinary everyday form or in the archetypal form of purgatorial fire, pyrocatharsis. We can have the feeling that our body is on fire, have visions of burning cities and forests, and identify with the victims of immolation. In the archetypal version, the burning seems to radically destroy whatever is corrupted in us and prepare us for spiritual rebirth. A classical symbol of the transition from BPM-3 to BPM-4 is the legendary phoenix, a bird who dies in fire and rises resurrected from the ashes. The pyrocathartic experience is a somewhat puzzling aspect of BPM-3, since its connection with biological birth is not as direct and obvious as is the case with the other symbolic elements. The biological counterpart of this experience might be the explosive liberation of previously blocked energies in the final stage of childbirth, or the overstimulation of the fetus with the indiscriminate firing of the peripheral neurons. It is interesting that this encounter with fire has its experiential parallel in the delivering mother, who at this stage of delivery often feels that her vagina is on fire. Several important characteristics of the third matrix distinguish it from the previously described no-exit stage. The situation here is challenging and difficult, but it does not seem hopeless, and we do not feel helpless. We are actively involved in a fierce struggle and have the feeling that the suffering has a definite direction, goal, and meaning. In religious terms, this situation is related to the concept of purgatory rather than hell. In addition, We do not just play the role of helpless victims. At this point, three different roles become available to us. Besides being observers of what is happening, we can also identify with both the aggressor and the victim. This can be so convincing that it might be difficult to distinguish and separate the roles. Also, while the no-exit situation involves suffering, the experience of the death-rebirth struggle represents the borderline between agony and ecstasy, and the fusion of both. It seems appropriate to refer to this type of experience as Dionysian, or volcanic ecstasy, in contrast to the Apollonian, or oceanic ecstasy, of the cosmic union associated with the first perinatal matrix. The following account from a high-dose LSD session illustrates many of the typical themes associated with BPM-3, as described above. Although I never really clearly saw the birth canal, I felt its crushing pressure on my head and all over, and I knew with every cell of my body that I was involved in the birth process. The tension was reaching dimensions that I had not imagined were humanly possible. I felt unrelenting pressure on my forehead, temples, and occiput, as if I were caught in the steel jaws of a vice. The tensions in my body had a brutally mechanical quality. I imagined myself passing through a monstrous meat grinder or a giant press full of cogs and cylinders. The image of Charlie Chaplin, victimized by the world of technology in modern times, briefly flashed through my mind. Incredible amounts of energy seemed to be flowing through my entire body, condensing and releasing in explosive discharges. I felt an amazing mixture of feelings. I was suffocated, frightened, and helpless, but also furious and strangely sexually aroused. Another important aspect of my experience was a sense of utter confusion. While I felt like an infant involved in a vicious struggle for survival and realized that what was about to happen was my birth, I was also experiencing myself as my delivering mother. I knew intellectually that being a man, I could never give birth, yet I felt that I was somehow crossing that barrier and that the impossible was becoming a reality. There was no question that I was connecting with something primordial, an ancient feminine archetype of the delivering mother. My body image included a large pregnant belly and female genitals with all the nuances of biological sensations. I felt frustrated by not being able to surrender to this elemental process, to give birth and be born, to let go and to let the baby out. An enormous reservoir of murderous aggression emerged from the underworld of my psyche. It was as if an abscess of evil had suddenly been punctured by the cut of a cosmic surgeon. A werewolf or a berserk was taking me over. Dr. Jekyll was turning into Mr. Hyde. There were many images of the murderer and the victim as being one and the same person, just as earlier I could not distinguish between the child who was being born and the delivering mother. I was a merciless tyrant, the dictator exposing his subordinates to unimaginable cruelties, and also a revolutionary, leading the furious mob to overthrow the tyrant. I became the mobster who murders in cold blood, and the policeman who kills the criminal in the name of the law. At one point, I experienced the horrors of the Nazi concentration camps. When I opened my eyes, I saw myself as an SS officer. I had a profound sense that he, the Nazi, and I, the Jew, were the same person. I could feel the Hitler and the Stalin in me, and felt fully responsible for the atrocities in human history. I saw clearly that humanity's problem is not the existence of vicious dictators, but this hidden killer that we all harbor within our own psyches, if we look deep enough. Then the nature of the experience changed and reached mythological proportions. Instead of the evil of human history, I now sense the atmosphere of witchcraft and the presence of demonic elements. My teeth were transformed into long fangs, filled with some mysterious poison, and I found myself flying on large bat wings through the night like an ominous vampire. This soon changed into wild, intoxicating scenes of a witch's Sabbath. In this strange sensual ritual, all the usually forbidden and repressed impulses seemed to surface and were experienced and acted out. I was aware of participating in some mysterious sacrificial ceremony, celebrating the dark god. As the demonic quality gradually disappeared from my experience, I still felt tremendously erotic and was engaged in endless sequences of the most fantastic orgies and sexual fantasies, in which I played all the roles. All through these experiences, I simultaneously continued being the child struggling through the birth canal and the mother delivering it. It became very clear to me that sex and birth were deeply connected, and that satanic forces had important links with the propulsion through the birth canal. I struggled and fought in many different roles and against many different enemies. Sometimes I wondered if there would ever be an end to my misery. Then a new element entered my experience. My entire body was covered with some biological filth, which was slimy and slippery. I could not tell if it was the amniotic fluid, urine, mucus, blood, or vaginal secretions. The same stuff seemed to be in my mouth and even in my lungs. I was choking, gagging, making faces and spitting, trying to get it out of my system and off my skin. At the same time, I was getting a message that I did not have to fight. The process had its own rhythm, and all I had to do was surrender to it. I remembered many situations from my life where I felt the need to fight and struggle, and in retrospect, that too felt unnecessary. It was as if I had been somehow programmed by my birth to see life as much more complicated and dangerous than it actually is. It seemed that this experience could open my eyes in this regard and make my life much easier and more playful than before.